Good morning, everyone. The earliest part of the Old Testament is the prophecy of Amos, which is in the middle of the 8th century BC. That's about 750. It's quite likely that the book of Genesis is about the year 500. So it's at the beginning of the Bible, but it's nowhere near the beginning of the written text. And that's after the exile. So to put the setting for the book of Genesis, we need to go back to the exile period and what they experienced there, because this is written as against that, with a beautiful understanding of Yahweh that they didn't find in Babylon. The Hebrew name for the text is there written for you in Hebrew, Bereshit. In the Torah, they take the first word, really, is the name of the book. So while we call it the book of Genesis, they call it Bereshit. During the Babylonian exile, the exiles from Judah came to contact with the religious ideas and cult of Babylon. And they were stunned at how primitive the Babylonians were. In Psalm 115 we read, "Why do nations say, where is their God?" Because they don't have an idol, you see, the Jews. "Our God is in the heavens and answers to no one," says the author. "Their gods are crafted by hand, mere silver and gold. They have mouths, yes, but they don't speak. They have eyes, but they don't see. They have ears, but they don't hear. Noses, but do not smell. They have hands, but they can't feel. They have feet, but they don't walk. No sound comes forth from their hollow throats. Those who make them are like them, as are all who trust in them." So they were stunned. They went into a much bigger culture in the Mesopotamian area, that's modern Iraq. They went into this wonderful ancient culture, but religiously it was quite bankrupt as they saw it. The part of the Isaiah scroll that comes from the exile, this is Isaiah chapter 44, likewise writes, "They don't know, nor do they comprehend this is their gods, the gods of Babylon. For their eyes are shut, they can't see, and their minds as well, so that they cannot understand. No one considers, nor is there knowledge or discernment to say, half of it," this is the idol, "half of it I burnt in the fire. I also baked bread on its coals. I roasted meat and have eaten. Now shall I make the rest of it an abomination, an idol? Shall I fall down before a block of wood? He feeds on ashes. A deluded mind has led him astray, and he cannot save himself or say, is not this thing a fraud?" And then we have to be careful. The Babylonians didn't worship wood, and they didn't worship stone or iron. These were the visual symbols of the god they worshipped, this mysterious being whose spirit they felt in it. But the outsiders, that's the Jews, came in, as we can do to other cultures. They came in and misread the culture. But in any case, they were surprised at how primitive the people's religious awareness was. On the New Year festival in Babylon, a festival to the Babylonian god Marduk, and the dramatic presentation of the Enuma Elish creation myth. This is what they heard and saw celebrated in Babylon. And this is giving rise to their thoughts that they'll express in Genesis. In the beginning, according to this Babylonian myth, there was nothing but the divine pair, Apsu and Tiamat. From these primordial deities, several generations of gods were begotten. But the repose of Apsu was disturbed by the secondary gods, whom he therefore decided to destroy, a proposal rejected by his consort Tiamat. The wise god Ea discovers the plan and takes preemptive action by killing Apsu with the help of magic. The birth of Marduk, the god of Babylon, follows, and his many attributes are described in the Enuma Elish. Meanwhile, Tiamat prepares for battle to avenge the death of her consort and appoints Kingu as head of the divine assembly, leader of her army and keeper of the tablets of destiny. Since the gods are afraid to take on Marduk, Tiamat, Marduk, also named as Bel, agrees to do so on the condition that he's appointed supreme god in the divine assembly. The gods accept with the acclamation, "Marduk is king." And by the way, in the book of Isaiah, written at the same time, they have parallels to this. Yahweh is king. They equip Marduk with a scepter, a royal robe, throne, and magical weapons. And in the contest that follows, Tiamat is defeated and killed, and out of her body are created the sky, the stars, the constellations, the sun and moon, the earth, and the waters surrounding the earth. The human being, according to this myth, was a lowly creature, Lulu, is created by the god Ea out of the blood of the slaughtered Kingu, mixed with slime. To humanity is assigned the task of relieving the secondary gods of the duty of serving the high gods. In gratitude, the gods erect the Esagila sanctuary for Marduk, Enlil and Ea. A banquet follows, and the destinies are fixed. The poem, the Enuma Elish, ends with a recital of a litany of the 50 names of Marduk and the praise of his incomparable greatness. None among the gods can equal Marduk. And Isaiah has, none among the gods can equal Yahweh. I'm trying to give you the impression or the understanding that the book of Genesis is written contrary to the myths that they're picking up in Babylon. The word myth, you go back to our own experience, and life is mysterious. There's mystery everywhere. And the MY at the beginning of mystery is the same MY at the beginning of myth. It's an expression of ultimate religious realities glimpsed but not able to be expressed except in the veiled language, and MY in Sanskrit means veil. So it's the veiled language of symbol, story, song, dance, and ritual. That's how they express the mystery. We still do. Scholars discern two different kinds of material in these first 11 chapters of Genesis, recognizable by their different styles, interests, and themes. We've got an account of creation, which we'll begin in a few moments, culminating in the blessing of the seventh day, a story of the flood, and a number of genealogies. These have the distinctive style of the priestly school. So back in Judah, after the return from exile, the priests have a significant role in creating this text, and their parts are recognizable through the genealogies, etc. But there's also, in these 11 chapters, a story of the beginnings of the human race, which looks at the human condition in the light of Israel's faith, not the faith of Babylon, but Israel's faith. And it includes the stories of Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, the flood, and the Tower of Babel. The authors of Genesis, so the group compiling this marvelous text, have blended this material into one continuous narrative. But scholars can see the seams where they've knitted one bit to another. Both strands are composed as counters to the primitive myths encountered in Babylon during the exile. And they declare that the God of Israel, Yahweh, is the creator of the universe and the Lord of history. Genesis presents an alternate view of creation to that found in the ancient Middle East. An alternate view of the origins of mankind and of the presence and action of God in the world. A view that is inspired by the distinctive faith of Israel in Yahweh and in the special relationship of God with Israel. These chapters 1 to 11 of Genesis, they're not history as we understand history. They do not narrate historical events. At the same time, and this is quite significant, they're not myth. For myth sets out to describe a stable and unchanging situation, usually supported by the cult, and one that favours the power exercised by the ruler, who's presented as divine. So the myths of Egypt, the Pharaoh is divine. The myths of Babylon, the king is divine. So it's a structured society, and the aim of myth is to create symbol and dance and music and poetry to secure the order of the king and the rest of us down below. The material we're going to study is quite different. The focus is on God as creator, on God's relationship with creation, and especially God's relationship with the human race, and on how people must live to benefit from God's blessing. It's a far more profound document than you can find anywhere else at the time. The text expresses inspired insights into God's design for creation and into why it is that God's design is sometimes thwarted by human sin. The kind of sin that's highlighted comes from the reflection on the kind of sin that brought about the destruction of Jerusalem and the Babylonian exile. That's what they're reflecting on. The post-exilic authors wanted their contemporaries to learn the right lessons and so not to repeat the sin of their ancestors. And so we begin the creation stories in Scripture. The part I'm going to do this morning is from the priestly document. The other document is often called Yahwist, because in the other document, God is called Yahweh, which for the priests is not on. For the priests, Yahweh was first revealed at the burning bush to Moses in Exodus chapter 3. So they don't ever call God Yahweh prior to the burning bush of Exodus. But the other group do. And that's one way of recognizing which author we're looking at, which strand. So let's look at the creation stories. Begins with a liturgical hymn from the priestly community. The text is composed for a community who thought that the world inhabited by human beings was at the center of the cosmos. They imagined the sky as a solid vault. Firmament is one name given to it. They knew that the world comprised land and sea, but they thought it was surrounded on all sides by the swirling waters of the primeval ocean. So the ocean is not the seas. The seas, the Mediterranean was one they knew best, and others. No, there's a water, the ocean surrounding everything, and so God built this firmament so that he could have space to work with all these swirling waters everywhere to keep the waters above separate from the waters below. Rain occurred when God arranged for the sluice gates in heaven to be opened and some of the ocean above the sky was poured out onto the sea and land. This is how they imagined their world. And it's these people whose inspired reflections we're about to read. There's a picture of the way they imagined their world. So different from ours. But they're writing with that imagination, so their words will portray it. Here you have the earth, down below where the dead are, go into the pit when they're buried. That's Sheol, it's the Hades of the Greeks. This is the great deep, the ocean. They're the clouds, of course, the sun and the moon. And then there's God in the highest heaven. And God is kind of, the heavens are revealed when you look. There's a beautiful planet out here at night at the moment. I don't know which one it is, but it's stunningly big, even for the ordinary eye. So that their light's into heaven. So if you're looking at a star, you're seeing a little glimpse through into the light. It's quite poetic and quite beautiful and quite true at one level. Having lost their temple, and so the temple cult, this is in exile, and when they came back, the temple was destroyed still, had to rebuild it. Their focus was on the community assembled in prayer. The Sabbath takes on a special importance now. It didn't before the exile, but it does now, because when they found themselves in exile, how did they express their religion? They couldn't go to the temple. They couldn't offer sacrifices. The priests had time to write, but not to do anything else. So they gathered in the synagogue, which emerged at that time, and they read from their scriptures to try and get meaning in their life, and the Sabbath became an especially important self-identifying feast for the Jews, and it's remained so ever since. The authors of this first chapter of Genesis have God create simply by his word. There's no slaughter of Tiamat and Apsu and Ea and all these other gods. No, God just creates by his word. In this way, they carefully preserve the transcendence of God, who creates by the power of his will. His word is enough. God speaks, and it's done. The priestly editors wish to focus on the power of God, on the basic goodness, indeed sacredness, of creation, and on God's word that, as promised, is the driving force of history. While their focus is not scientific but religious, the authors are men of their time. This is the era of Pythagoras, of Heraclitus. The poem we're about to study shows signs of their being in touch with contemporary scientific interest. They think of humanity as living in community, with responsibilities from God for carrying on the work of creation, caring intelligently for the universe created by God for humankind. As priests, their interest is primarily in the cult and in praise of God. The poem is an exultant hymn of praise for the wonders of creation. There were various ways of imagining creation in the ancient Near Eastern texts. I'll just share this with you too. One way of understanding creation is generation from the gods. I've already presented a quick outline of the Enuma Elish from Babylon. You don't find any of this, of course, in the Bible. Another way of imagining it is a cosmic struggle between God and the forces of chaos. In the Greek world, the origin of all things prior to the gods, prior to Zeus, is chaos. That's the origin. Well, chaos is darkness and swirling waters imagined, and there's a battle between God and chaos in this way of imagining creation. You do find this in the Bible. It's a poetic picking up of local language to try to speak of the wonder of God. And you've got to read it poetically, of course. Awake, says Isaiah 51, awake, awake, clothe yourself with strength, O arm of Yahweh. Awake, as in the days gone by, as in generations of old. Was it not you who cut Rahab to pieces, who pierced that monster through? This was God creating, killing the monster of evil and chaos. Psalm 74, you divided the sea by your might. You broke the heads of the dragons in the sea. You crushed the heads of Leviathan. You gave him as food for the creatures of the wilderness. A third way, and we're getting gradually more careful, I suppose you could say, is creation is God is the potter, and he's the making the creation. Here we have Book of Genesis, which I'll come to later, of course. Yahweh God. So we're dealing now in this text with the Yahwist group, not the priests. Yahweh God, shaped humanity. Adam doesn't mean, it's not a person. Adam means humanity. Shaped humanity from the dust of the soil. We'll look at this text later, but Adam is human being or humanity, and Adama is the soil. So there's a poetic connection there, of course. And Yahweh God breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and a human being became a living being. Yahweh, so he's forming us like the potter from the dust. It's rather a beautiful image in a way, because if it were clay, you could put it on a mantelpiece and it'd stay there. But since we're made of dust, you and I wouldn't exist unless God kept his hands there, holding us in existence. Because we're only dust. Take his hands away and we don't last unless we're held. Isaiah 64 reads, Yahweh, you are our maker. We're the clay. You're the potter. We're all the work of your hand. And the book of Job, remember that you moulded me like clay. Will you turn me back to dust? Genesis 1, verse 1, an acclamation of praise of the Creator, which reads, in the beginning, Bereshit, or Genesis, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. I've got the Hebrew word there for create, bara. It means to cut, to separate out, to divide. And it's only ever found in the Bible with God as the subject. No one else. Bara, only God. So it's a very uniquely special word. Bara. God created the heavens and the earth. Psalm 33 reads, by God's word. This is the way that the Bible presents creation. By God's word the heavens were made, and by God's breath all their starry hosts. Then the text goes on. The earth was without form, an empty wasteland, and darkness was over the face of the primeval deep. So you've got swirling waters, no division, that's all you've got, chaos in other words. You've got chaos and the earth where we're now living was a formless, without form, and there's the Hebrew for you, tohu vabohu. It's powerful imagery. I've quoted it because I want to show you where it comes from. The earth was an empty wasteland. Tohu vabohu, and darkness was over the face of the primeval deep, the ocean. So prior to creation, there's no life, there's no orientation. It's like a desert. Everything goes nowhere, you don't know where you are. There's no orientation, no distinctions, no forms, no space, no time. Only general darkness and the chaos of undifferentiated swirling waters. Waters remains an image of chaos right through into the New Testament too. That's the story of storm at sea and so on. Isaiah writes, from generation to generation it will lie desolate. There's your word, tohu. No one will ever pass through it again. God will stretch out over Edom the measuring line of chaos and the plumb line of desolation, bohu. So he's used both these words. In exile, he's writing, or pre-exile, in fact, but those words are taken by the book of Genesis to create in one verse an image of what things were like before creation. Here's Jeremiah also writing prior to the exile. And he writes, I looked at the earth, and it was without form and empty. Tohu vabohu. Same expression. Genesis chapter 4. And I looked at the heavens, and their light was gone. Everything, because of the destruction of Jerusalem, it's coming. Everything's reverting right back to the original chaos. I looked at the mountains, and they were quaking, and all the hills were swaying. I looked, and there were no people. Every bird in the sky had flown away. I looked, and the fruitful land was a desert. This poet, prophet, using these expressions to talk about what was the returning of chaos. And of course, that's the language picked up by the authors of Genesis. Genesis reads, so it's darkness, it's tohu vabohu, and then God's breath, spirit, swept over the surface of the waters. The beginnings of creation. God's spirit. Deuteronomy 32 reads, in a desert land I found him, in a barren and howling waste. He shielded him and cared for him. This is Israel. He guarded him as the apple of his eye, like an eagle that stirs up its nest and hovers over its young, that spreads out its wings to catch them and carries them on his pinions. An extraordinarily beautiful image from the book of Deuteronomy. They're imagining, how did we get from Egypt to Mount Sinai? Well, God, like an eagle, took us across the desert, carried the nation, and took them to the sacred mountain. So that's a description of the beginning, before anything's happened. Now we go on. From Genesis chapter 1, 3 to 19, the rest of this morning's presentation, we move from chaos to the cosmos. The aim of the account is not to surprise, but to create a sense of peace from the underlying stability of things, from the transcendent divine view. In the opening hymn in Genesis, God creates simply by his word. The text reads, God said, let light be, and light was. They didn't think that light came from the sun, because there's light in the sky well before the sun rises, as you've noticed. And when the sun set, there's still light. So light was something pre-sun and moon and all the rest of it. They don't come till the fourth day. So the first thing God does to create is light, so that God can see what he's doing. It's fair enough. And according to our modern, the best we've got, light, we're talking about 14 billion years ago by our scientific standards, this happened. And God said, God saw the light, that it was good. This is so important, so different from any of the mythology around the place. God saw it was good. Everything that comes from the hands of God has to be essentially good. Now, not everything, not all of us are entirely good. So we've got to look at why that is. But that's not what we're talking about now. He's talking about whatever comes from God's hand is good. And God separated the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness light. And it was evening, and it was morning. Day one. That's an engraving by the famous illustrator Gustave Doré. I'll put a few of them up there for you. And there's God saying, let there be light. The text continues. Scene 2 of creation. God said, let there be a dome in the midst of the waters to be a separation between the waters and the waters. Get space to work. And God made the dome that separated the waters that were under the dome from the waters that were above the dome. And it was so. And God called the dome sky. And it was evening and morning, a second day. Scene 3. God said, let the waters under the sky under the sky be gathered together in one place, and let dry land appear. Notice God doesn't create the earth. It's there all the time. But when the waters are separated out, oh, we see the earth. He gathered into one place, let the dry land appear. And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together, seas. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let the earth sprout forth fresh sprouts, plants which produce seed, and fruit trees that bear fruit, each of its kind containing its own seed on the earth. And it was so. And the earth brought forth fresh sprouts, plants which produce seed, each of its kind, and fruit trees that bear fruit containing its own seed, each of its kind. And God saw that it was good. It was evening and morning, a third day. I'm sure you can see this is a poem. It's not a scientific description of creation, but it's quite beautiful, and there's an order in it that's quite sound. So all these beautiful ferns appeared, fruit trees. And God said, now we come, let there be lights in the dome of the sky to separate between the day and the night. Separate, bara. To separate between the day and the night, and to be signs for the seasons, for the days and years, the moon for their measured time. The sun was what we know it to be. And let there be lights in the dome of the sky to give light on the earth. And it was so. And according to modern science, where the sun and the moon emerge about 5 billion years ago. And God made the two great lights. They're not named because the sun was worshipped in Egypt, and the moon was worshipped in Babylon. So rather than give them their names, because they could sound like false gods, they just leave it very general. Two great lights. The great light to rule over the day, and the small light to rule over the night and the stars. And God set them in the dome of the sky. The sky has them there. To give light on the earth, to rule over the day and night, and to separate between light and darkness. And God saw that it was good. It was evening and morning, a fourth day. I just want to read to you from the book of Job. Excuse me. Chapter 38. This is Ronald Knox. 1949, he produced this whole marvellous one man's job. He's a great wordsmith. But the time in history was unfortunate in a way, because this only lasted 15 or 16 years. Then came the Vatican Council and the Jerusalem Bible, which is excellent, of course. So poor Ronald Knox's work is on shelves. So I thought I'd resurrect it a bit for you. And I just want to read to you chapter 38. Job is possibly also post-exilic and reflecting on the pain of the exile, the destruction of Jerusalem and all that, and how the innocent suffer along with the good. And Job, who's innocent, is complaining to God, "Why am I suffering?" And all the people around him are giving him great advice, but it's all wrong. They're standing for the ancient idea that if you suffer, you must have sinned. And he said, "But I haven't sinned." And he's right, he hadn't. But this debate goes on and on and on. And then at the end, the poet, takes us somewhere else. We can't understand suffering. We can't understand why the innocent suffer. All these mysteries. But we've got to stop looking in here. We've got to look out at the wonder of creation, and I hope you enjoy it. I've got no voice this morning, but I guess you can still hear me. From the midst of the whirlwind, the Lord gave Job his answer. "Here is one that must ever be clouding the truth of things with words ill-considered. Strip then and enter the lists. It's my turn to ask questions now, and it's yours to answer them. From what vantage point were you watching when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me, whence comes this sure knowledge of thine? Tell me, since you're so wise, was it you or I designed earth's plan, measuring it out with the line? How came its base to stand so firm? Who laid its cornerstone? To me that day, all the morning stars sang together, all the powers of heaven uttered their joyful praise. Was it you or I shut in the sea behind bars? No sooner had it broken forth from the womb than I dressed it in swaddling clothes of dark mist, set it within bounds of my own choosing, and made fast with bolt and bar. Thus far thou shalt come, I said, and no further. Here let thy swelling waves spend their force. Do you, a mortal, take command of the day's breaking, a and show the dawn its appointed post, twitching away earth's coverlet, scaring away the ill-doers. The dawn that stamps its image on the clay of earth stands there, flung over it like a garment, taking away from the ill-doers the darkness that is their light, so that all their power goes for nothing. Did you ever make your way into the sea's depth, walk at their ease through its hidden caverns? When did the gates of death open to you and give you sight of the gloomy threshold? Nay, hast thou viewed the whole surface of the earth itself? And it goes on and on quite beautifully, but I'll leave it with that. Another contemporary, probably, poetic attempt to get us to marvel at creation. God's action on the fourth day sees chaos overcome by divine power and our beautiful cosmos established. Heavens, earth, seas, stars, sun and moon. God's creative action is celebrated in a spirit of wonder and praise. God has spoken. Creation is good, and God can be trusted to continue to care for the creation God has made. And I'll conclude with Psalm 65 and play some music for you. And then when we return at 11:30, I'll complete this priestly song or exultant hymn of praise about creation. Psalm 65 reads, "Those who live at earth's farthest bounds are awed by your signs. You make the gateways of the morning and the evening shout for joy. You visit the earth and water it. You greatly enrich it. The river of God is full of water. You provide the people with grain. You water its furrows, settling its ridges, softening it with showers, and blessing its growth. You crown the year with your bounty. The pastures of the wilderness overflow. The hills gird themselves with joy. The meadows clothe themselves with flocks. The valleys deck themselves with grain. They shout for joy. Yes, they sing."